And that's all we have time for on Sound and Fury, DJ Faulkner's sunny show for today. Leave you wanting more, as usual. And up next is Living Writers. I've really enjoyed having my audience from 4 to 5 on Wednesdays. I can't wait to see you next semester in the fall. I hope you enjoyed.
You are listening to 88.3 WCBN FM Ann Arbor.
Afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel. And we've got Stephanie Douglas Carpenter engineering behind the glass today. And that was George Cooper's song, George of Home George, his song, Maybe. The Living Writers theme song. Hope you all have been enjoying that. And welcome to today's program. I'm happy to be here. I hope everyone's hanging in there. It's the last week of term, so I know it's a crazy time out there. So hope you guys hope everyone out there is having a good day and hanging in there. And good luck to all. Next week on the program, we have poet and friend of the show Raymond McDaniel in the studio. So looking forward to that. On today's show, we have a taping with visiting poet and scholar Moja Kaf. In March, the Center for Middle Eastern and North African Studies welcomed poet and scholar Moja Kaf for poetry events. Kaf read from her newest collection, Hagar Poems, University of Arkansas Press, 2016, which won honorable mention in the 2017 Book Awards of the Arab American National Museum. Moja Kaf was born in Damascus, Syria, but grew up in the U.S. Midwest. Her childhood experiences shaped her perceptions of the differences and similarities between the cultures of her home and adopted countries. Syria, Islam, ethics, politics, feminism, human rights, the body, gender, and erotics often feature in her work. Kaf also reconfigures many female figures of the Islamic tradition, particularly in Hagar Poems. In emails from Scheherazade, out with the University Press of Florida in 2003, which was a finalist for the 2004 Patterson Poetry Prize, Kaf locates Scheherazade in 21st century Hackensack, New Jersey. Kaf also has written about the hardships of immigration in The Girl and the Tangerine Scarf, out with Carolyn Groff, 2006. This book depicts a Muslim girl's coming of age in Indiana. Kaf co-writes a column on sexuality for the website Muslim Wake Up. She was a founding member of RAWI, the Radius of Arab American Writers, and is currently a member of the Syrian Nonviolence Movement. Kaf earned a PhD in comparative literature from Rutgers University and is a professor of English at the University of Arkansas. And now a word about the center itself. The Center for Middle Eastern and North African Studies at the University of Michigan provides a venue for faculty, students, and the community to learn and share knowledge about the Middle East and North Africa through an active lecture series and various educational and research programs, and by partnering with a host of units across campus on projects of mutual interest. So many thanks to Rima at the Center for Middle Eastern and North African Studies for not only for bringing Moja Kaf to the station for our conversation back in March, but also for generously bringing books for us to give away to 10 lucky callers today. And Moja signed them especially here at the studio. Thanks also to Sarah Messer and One Pause Poetry for making the initial connection. So now we're going to get to the show, I promise. The taped, don't worry, we're going to get to that, folks. But now for a word about the book, Hegar Poems, because this is the book that you could win by calling in. The central matter of this daring new collection is the story of Hagar, Abraham, and Sarah, the ancestral feuding family of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. From multiple angles and in varying voices, these poems, informed by the Hajar story in Islam, treat rituals of Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca. They explore other figures from the Near Eastern heritage, such as Mary and Moses. And they are full of artful reconfiguring. Readers will find modernized figures and sequels and prequels to the traditional narrative. Hagar Poems is a compelling shakeup, not only of Hagar's story, but also of current roles of all kinds of women in all kinds of relationships. So, folks, it's an exciting day here. Give us a call and win one of these signed books. One of the Hagar poem books. You can call 734-763-3500. And if the line is busy, please try again. And now, let's play today's show. I hope you enjoy it. Good afternoon and welcome to Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today Moja Kaf is here in the studio. I'm so excited, and we've got on the table with us Hagar Poems and also emails from
Shehrazad.
Thank you. So glad to have you here in the studio. Thanks for coming down while you're here in town. You're here for Syrian Dreams, Siren Blasts, a talk given at the Rackham Amphitheater, Friday, March 23rd. So hopefully some folks had a chance to check it out. And Poems of Hagar and Her Sisters, March 24th. And that's at the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn. I am happy to see you. I've been looking forward to this all day. So thanks for being here.
So
let's talk a little bit about the Hagar poems that you have here on the table with us. Could you say talk a little bit about the origin story behind these and how, like, was it first like a voice, one of the parts of the poems, or how did this collection start taking shape?
The origin story is right there in one of the poems.
Great. Shall we hear it and go from there?
And it's called Hajar No Roses, or Hagar No Roses. I only understood Hajar when my baby got a fever. It was late, and we were just off Medicaid, and above the poverty line, but not enough for insurance plans or private doctors. It was my first baby. I didn't know when not to worry. I knew high fevers could damage brains if left too long. I knew the little body felt wrong, shook slightly, eyes rolled back, not responding to acetaminophen. The on-call at the ER was busy. Didn't phone back for what seemed like hours. While I paced like Ethiopian Hajar in her desert, watching Ismail's small sunken chest gasp up and down in throes of thirst. Hagar did not slump over the body waiting for what grace might come. She shook her fist at the angel. Help us. It was not a plea, but a demand. I went through lists of people I knew. Who would know what to do for babies? Who willing to wake to worry with me, ringing the bouquets of useless roses they'd laid at the foot of motherhood. I hated knowing. I would humble myself to phone them in the middle of the night, to stand with arms down by my side, however long, whatever their conditions, if they would tell me what the baby needed now. Hajar, no roses here. Motherhood is bitter fighting against death forces in a desert of indifference. Provide water. Provide balm. If there is any salve in the world, it is for this here now, the infant small flames that rise in irises to flicker like tigers.
Thank you.
So that was the origin story.
Yeah.
It was just this sense of there's not a lot of support for motherhood. I was a young mother. And where was everybody after all the lifelong, you know, idealization of motherhood and so on? And where were they all? And I, you know, compared to a lot of mothers in this world, had it okay. Many places without access to medical care, many places under much more dire conditions, right. But still I felt abandoned in the desert
and alone. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so was that like literally like the like you were you able to work then also? Were you drafting poems during this time, or is this because I can imagine not being able to necessarily be writing when this was happening? So are these memories that come back, or was this actually part of who you are as a maker, as a poet, as a writer, where you're able to be drafting during the moment even?
Not during that night.
Not
no.
That night. Yeah, clearly.
But I don't think it was very much longer. I think it was, you know, I mean, when I say not very much longer, I mean, it was probably within the year or two when I had time to just think these through, think, you know, when you're feeling something and then when you can think through how you were feeling something. Right?
Having that bit of distance can be,
But that was 28 years ago. So that was the first Hajar poem. So then I had been, you know, I just went on writing them every once in a while, not with a conscious focus that I am going to write them until they are a book. You know, they were just among the poems that I would write. And then around 2003, 2004, I have enough to make a manuscript.
And then, and in this manuscript, thanks to Charlie Shields for sending along this PDF.
Yeah, from University of Arkansas Press. Woo! Thanks, Charlie.
Yeah, shout out to Charlie. I'm wondering if one of the early poems in... Because then of course, you didn't do this chronologically. Because when you went to tell, like when I asked about the origin story, you dove into like almost midway
page
into
21.
The book, page 21. Okay, so not, but I feel like in the early poems, like why this? Because then when you're deciding on the sequence, how did these pieces come? Like because then we've got the water of Hajar, the first thing.
Yeah. So then the ordering of the poems, you know, I mean, I went through many different orders and it took a long time, but I finally ordered them in a way that's not the only way that they could be ordered, but that I hope helps to tell the story to the reader. So these are, a lot of them are persona poems. That first one was not. There's an I in it that's reflecting on Hagar or Hajar that's not the same as the I in the poem. But there are a lot of them that I just, the poem speaker steps into the persona of Hajar sometimes, and sometimes Sarah, and sometimes even Abraham, Isaac.
That Ismael. Allows some freedom mm-hmm. then too. Why was it important to have it from these multiple perspectives?
You know, just thinking about the story and what it might have meant to different sides of it, and how many different ways the story is picked up throughout history by various cultures and societies.
Could you give the story that you're working from? Because I have a connect, like, think of it biblically. Like, that's
sure,
like
that is
one
this,
of the
yeah.
first associations.
So Abraham is married to Sarah. Sarah seems to be unable to have a child. She gifts a concubine, Hajar, to Abraham to have a child. And Hajar does indeed have a child, the firstborn son of Abraham, named Ishmael. And then, miraculously, Sarah is given the chance to conceive, and she has
suddenly
Isaac.
Fertile.
Yeah. And then things go bad between Sarah and Hajar, and Sarah wants her out. And then depends on if you're reading the Islamic traditional version of it, which is really collected from lore and from hadith rather than fully in the Quran or the biblical. Anyway, Hajar ends up abandoned in the desert in, you know, whichever one you read, ends up in the desert and with Ismail. And in some versions, he's an infant. In some versions, he's 13. You know, so I don't really know. We don't, who knows? They're all narrations, right? So I accept all the narrations and
all
I try to
stories,
work with all the different stories.
And yeah. What are the meanings or what are the reasons behind these changes, like in what the tone or the feeling or what it's trying to show us, what they might
well,
be?
Well, some are set in a modern, you know, trying to imagine them in modern dramas of a wife and another woman, migration. Hajar is an immigrant. Is a displaced person, is an immigrant, is a lot of these things, depending on which poem you want. And how does the first person in a new place, you know, how do they structure their daily life when there is no structure, right? And through history, also, I learned that different, you know, in the Middle Ages, medieval Christians saw Jews as Hagar's children because they were the Old Covenant, and Sarah was New Covenant and had the grace and so on. But then from a Jewish perspective, more often, they see themselves as Sarah's children and Ishmael as, you know, the Muslims are Ishmael or the Ishmaelites. And then in American, U.S., in the United States, African Americans, in the 19th century, often look to Hajar, and in the 20th century, and all through African American literature, as a woman who had been enslaved, but, you know, who overcame adversity
to be the head of another house,
mm-hmm.
right?
Well, her own,
her own house.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at the
or not literal house, but a culture or a family.
And then it's also a feminist critique, a Muslim feminist critique of Islam, because here she is, she's the foremother of the Prophet Muhammad, but she's kind of footnoted.
Let's take a short break and then we'll come back. Today on the program, Moshe Kaf is here. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Stephanie behind the glass. We'll be back.
Now I greet you from the other.
So now, everybody, this would be a great time to give a call if you'd like to win one of Moshe Kaf's book of poems, Hagar Poems. So call now, 734-763-3500 to win your copy, your signed copy of Hagar Poems by Moja Kaf. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers, and we'll be back.
And despair with a love so vast and shattered, it will reach you everywhere. And I sing this for the captain whose ship has not been built, for the mother nights of wild distress, though your promise count for nothing, you must keep it nonetheless. You must keep it for the captain whose ship has not been built, for the mother
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm glad you did. Today on the program, Moja Kaf is here. We've been talking about the Hagar poems, and we're going to get back to that. But first, I'd just like to say a word about why we're lucky to have her with us here today and for the time here up in Michigan. The Center for Middle Eastern and North African Studies at the University of Michigan is the place we have to thank for this. This center provides a venue for faculty, students, and the community to learn and share knowledge about the Middle East and North Africa through an active lecture series and various educational and research programs, and by partnering with a host of units across campus on projects of mutual interest. The Center for Middle Eastern and North African Studies is a member of the International Institute, and WCBN and FM is thrilled to be partnering with everyone. And it's great to meet Rima, too, who's part of our studio audience. So we're pretty lucky today.
Woohoo!
Indeed. Thanks for choosing the songs for today's program. Okay, so let's go back to this part about it even being, if you don't mind, going back to where we left off before the break with this almost like a critique of sorts. Can you say more about this?
Yeah, so it is because of Hajar that we have certain rituals in the Hajj. So the two stones, Safa and Marwa, that pilgrims typically walk between, and in a certain portion of the route they sort of trot or jog, because she did that with anxiety because she's running back and forth between these two boulders, to really anxious about the health, the declining health of her child. And the irony is that in the current way that the pilgrimage is policed and regulated, women, not men, but women, are not allowed to do the running there. They have to walk and not run.
But why the women specifically, when it actually was a woman doing the
Oh, because of boobs. Because of jiggling boobs.
But,
basically, because it's like it's unseemly for women's bodies to be seen running.
Even if, but
and it's about a woman.
It's a reality
running.
Of the story.
It's about right. a woman running,
not
for
the
bodily
men.
Reasons.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
There are no men on the horizon. There are no men in sight. It is a woman making it on her own as a single mother. And also, that's another way in which it resonates with many people. Is it is the story of a single mother raising a son. Yeah. And so, and then in the, just the whole, I look at Hajj coverages every year, whether in mainstream papers, you know, Western US, US Muslim blogs, and try to sort of, how many of them even foreground Hajar when they're explaining the roots of the Hajj pilgrimage, right?
Is it not mentioned?
Very few. It, you know, I've found a few who are getting a little more progressive about that, but it always, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's explained as Abraham's rituals, you know, rituals that are commemorating Abraham. And there are some, but Abraham was there because Hajar was there.
Right.
Because Hajar wound up there.
And why is it across religions that women are so often written out of it? I mean, even if they're part of it, they're always mm-hmm. a subsidiary. It's, well, maybe there's an argument to be made for Mary. Who knows? but.
I have Mary poems in here, too.
Maybe we can.
Yeah. No, I mean, Muslim women had it much better than Christian women for most of history.
Which is
They had the right to inherit property, which if, you know, British women had that, we would not have half of Jane Austen's novels or half of, you know, some of Russian literature's most famous works like Anna Karenina would not exist because Muslim women had and exercised the right to initiate divorce and to remarry. So
which
until
is seemingly
rather recently in the 20th century, yeah, you know, and these were rights that were actually pursued. Judith Tucker, for example, a scholar who has studied Ottoman court records in the 19th century for Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, looks at property ownership as being something that was actually in practice. It wasn't just on paper.
How does this scholarship affect what more recent trends are? Like, how is this argument being made to show that historically this has been, like, why has there been these, why have women lost some things? Or, well, maybe that's too much. We got to get back to the poems, too, for sure.
We will. So it's about how the West, for lack of a better term, how European and American discourses framed Muslim women.
The stereotypes.
Even when, during the era of high colonialism, when women in those countries had far greater rights to own property as a married woman, for example. The Married Women's Property Act did not pass in Britain until 1872, and really not until 1882, and a bit later did married women get full rights over their property. But it's about needing to frame these women who we are planning on colonizing and dominating their countries as being liberated by us, right? And so that's the dominant power discourse, power knowledge discourse out of which this comes and will continue to come no matter how many people get on the air and talk about it being a stereotype, no matter how many positive images, you know, are out there about Muslim women in clothing advertisements or whatever. The negative side is based on the power knowledge relationship. And so that is still going to keep producing that discourse. But it's not because women aren't actually oppressed. They are in ways that are, you know, in Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, six of one, half dozen of the other. Pretty much. If you strip away the material. I mean, in the Middle Ages, Muslim women had it far better than Christian women simply because they lived in far better economic, you know, prosperity, because they lived in empires with things like running water, hot water, hygiene, soap. Seriously.
Exactly. Right? I know.
Dr. Samer Ali was pointing out at breakfast today that the Crusaders brought back soap, you know, from Syria, which was a big industry in Syria. Women made soap, by the way, in Syria. Anyway, so they had it better for those reasons having to do with economic and political reality and the reality of empires. And also today, women who happen to be Christian and live in the empire, the countries of empire, who are citizens of empire, have it better largely because of economic and political conditions that improve the options that are available to them. So when we're talking about just stripping it away to what rights do they have in each religion? Honestly, it's six of one, half dozen of the other.
And the thing that's unfortunate is that it feels like it's seriously far too complicated to ever do that. But the people who want to manipulate the discourse, the power discourse or so, are the ones that are making sure that that's the narrative.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not a conspiracy. It's not like a conscious thing. It's just always going to be produced that way as long as there's that power interest in producing it that way. It's something that people are naturalized to believe, whether they are the people who are in power or not. It's like a hegemony of ideas that they feel invested in believing in because it makes them able to support where the war budget is going, for example, right. Or makes them able to feel like their lives, even though they may be poor people living in America, that their lives are at least better than others.
And also sometimes never like learning how to question
mm-hmm.
what things as they are as well. Like as if your one reality is the one that's for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
sure. But can I say,
oh, please,
there's yeah. not just Hajar poems and Sarah and Abraham and Ishmael poems in the book.
Yes. You mentioned Mary is in it.
Right.
And so how else are you seeing, like, what is the whole world here? I guess briefly, and then we can come back to it after the break.
So the book is divided into three sections. And the middle section is about all these other women that are in shared scriptures shared by Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, and some that are just in Islamic history and heritage. So it starts out with a woman who in Islamic heritage is called Asiya, but exists in scriptures as well. In the Bible, she is in Exodus. She is Moses' surrogate mother. So she's seen as the daughter of the Pharaoh, right, who takes him out of the river when he's in the basket in the reeds and bulrushes. In Islamic tradition, she's seen as the Pharaoh's wife, the wife of the reigning Pharaoh who does this, who takes him out of the bulrushes and raises him. And so I see her as a figure who is kind of like white women today, white women who are allied to or married to or part of a privileged class, right, but are critical of it, but are still
part of
it. Yeah. And she's critical, but she doesn't know how to get out. And so she's kind of slowly going mad. And so there are these poems in there. Yeah. And then there's a woman whom Islamic tradition calls Zuleika. And this is not a name that's anywhere in the Quran, but she is also in the Bible. She's Potiphar's wife in the Bible. And she's this sexy seductress, bad Jezebel type woman. In the Quran, actually, she is also someone who attempts to seduce Joseph as his master's wife. But she has this interesting second chapter in the Quranic story of Joseph where she repents. And she says that she has remained loyal. And the question there is, there's just a little ambiguity in the way that the words are on the page. And could it be that she has remained loyal to Joseph and that she is truly in love? Or is she talking about being loyal to her Lord, meaning God? And in both cases, she's just a far more interesting woman than Potiphar's wife.
Completely.
Yeah, she's this woman who has caused scandal, but really has this sincerity and impassioned side of her. And the thing is that in the rest of, in a lot of other literatures, aside from the strictly scriptural type sacred literatures, meaning the Quran and then later the Hadith, which are considered, right, like central to the religion, she also becomes a subject of literature. So in Persian, there's a whole, it's almost a novel in poetic form. It's a poetic, long poetic narrative called Yusuf and Zuleika about Joseph and Potiphar's wife. And they it's kind of gives the prequel and the sequel. Yeah. So it's based on just the another version, another adaptation of Zuleika from various angles. And then I have Mary. And I use Mary in one of the poems to talk about
I use Mary in one of the poems to talk about teen girl depression. There is a remarkable passage in the Mary chapter of the Quran where Mary says she's out alone, pregnant, and having left her townspeople and family, and she just sits beneath a tree and says, I wish I was just dead and forgotten. You know, she's all alone. So I don't know, there's just so many 20-somethings out there and teens who are just so vulnerable, and life is so rough and confusing and hard for them. And I wrote that when I was a teen, in my teens, that particular poem in the book, that particular poem about Mary. And then there are a few other poems.
And so this is a collection that spans across then some, decades.
Well, yeah. And then there's women in Muhammad's life. So there's Fatima, his daughter, there's Khadija, there's Aisha, and a few other, you know, women from here and there in Islamic history. And then part three actually moves out of the persona poems into, I don't know, just kind of a loose set of poems that also have to do with like religion, post-religion, thinking about things, thinking about what happens when the idea of God is let out of the mosque or the church or the synagogue and let loose, you know, just poems.
Like into the world. So, and are those poems also, were they more recent in the making? Or also a blend across some?
Yeah, I think the book is just poems that they're all, I mean, I had sent this book out a good over 10 years ago. So most of those poems, even in that third section, were written really in the early 2000s, I guess, the first half of the 2000s, maybe.
And so, but then this also speaks to the importance of sending the book out and keeping faith in it.
Sure.
Right?
I figured when it finds a home, it finds a home. You know,
in the right home.
Yeah.
Then. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a beautiful book.
Yeah. And the art on the cover was done by Haja Ann Saunders. I bought one of her other paintings. It was about Balqis, the queen of Sheba, who falls in love with Solomon. And that painting is hanging in my house. I love that painting. It's just got such rich layers and textures. And this one, too, I love the one on the cover is she titled that after The Water of Hajar, the first poem in the book. This was before the book was a book. You know, I had sent her the manuscript and said, see, what if these, you know, do these do anything for you in terms of your painting? I would love to see your painting and my poetry kind of meet in some work. And then one day, if it gets published, I would like to be able to buy that one of those paintings for the book cover. And it worked. Yay. Thank you, Haja Ann Saunders.
That I love that story. And that doesn't seem like that's not out of the ordinary for, I think, who you are as an artist and as a maker, because I was seeing how you collaborate. Like you've been working, like you've put songs to music. You've Jenny Holzer, like you do these collaborations, right, out in the world. So this is sort of one of the ways you tick.
Yeah, I have been honored by, you know, being approached by some people who are music composers or conceptual artists like Jenny Holzer. And yeah, I love that. I think that's wonderful. Both my daughters are in their 20s and are artists in addition to many other things that they do, but they both really are genuine artists.
Let's take a short break and then we'll come back. Today on the program, Moshe Kaf is here. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Stephanie behind the glass. We'll be back. And today, everyone, we've got signed copies of Hegar poems to give away. Call 734-763-3500. That's 734-763-3500. Thanks to the winners so far, Chaitali Jane and the Liz Wasson book winners. So call 734-763-3500 to win your signed copy of Hagar Poems by Moja Kaf.
خمرة الحب اسقنيها هم قلبي تنسينيها خمرة الحب اسقنيها هم قلبي تنسينيها عيشة لا حب فيها جدول لا ماء فيه جدول لا ماء فيه جدول لا ما في خمرة الحب اسقنيها خم قلبي تنسيني عيشة لا حب فيها جدول لا ما فيه جدول لا ماء فيه جدول لا ماء فيه حملة الحب اسقنيها أما قلبي تنسيني حملة الحب اسقنيها عيشة لا حب فيها جدول
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Moja Kaf is here. And we've been talking about the Hagar Poems out with the University of Arkansas Press. The beautiful art on the cover. We don't have the girl in a tangerine scarf with us on the table today, but I'd love to take like a quick moment to talk about this novel of yours, a coming of age story, a young girl growing up in Indiana and feeling like an outsider. This was a novel that became like a reading at Indiana University. Is that true? Like, it was, yeah. Tell us a little bit about the life of this novel of yours, if you don't mind.
Yeah. So it took me 5 years to write. I was initially writing for my two daughters who were very young then.
The narrator, I wondered if it had some autobiographical, strong connections for you.
It obviously does. Anybody who knows me sees that. But it's also a composite. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a literal, the literal plot of it did not happen right. to me. And it's a composite of the experiences of many people who were in my childhood and some of them who do see themselves in various characters. But each of the characters is a composite of people in the communities that I grew up in, plural, in different states.
Mm-hmm. And you were writing it for your two daughters.
I was initially, but it shifted. Yeah.
Shifted to become
just
more
a larger
of its
story.
Own
yeah. Yeah.
Thing as it grew into the novel, perhaps? Like it became its
yeah.
own thing?
Mm hmm. Like it started out, you know, just to tell them about a material reality and a. You know, social and emotional reality of a kind of way of growing up that they did not experience, but that I came from. And also kind of in a way to recreate the 70s of Muslims in the Midwest for them.
Which would be valuable to know.
Before it fades from people's memories, right?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And so they've read it?
One and a half.
Okay. And is it something then, I don't know, like, what do you do then as a, like, as a poet and writer? Is it something that, like, do you want to talk about it with them? Or how does, like, how does that work? Because here there's this novel that's out in the world. And maybe it, when they get older, because you said they're in their 20s now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe later. I don't know. Mom and daughters.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's can be complicated.
Yeah, it can. I mean, I guess that part is something that we would talk about if the three of us were here.
Right.
But it's not just mine to talk about.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So I hear you've got some new poems that are here with you.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the new work.
I would love to. So this is a poem from a manuscript I have that is Syria poems that I started writing in 2011 when the nonviolent uprising began in Syria before it deteriorated into something else. When it started to deteriorate into a multi-party violent eruption, it became very, there was so much that was being obscured. There was so much in the way that language was being used that obscured what people were experiencing, such that sentences no longer made sense. People would say, you know, the Syrians are being bombed. Well, who is bombing them? Where is this misery coming from? You know, so people would talk about Syrian suffering, but not have any kind of accountability in order to avoid the difficult questions, the complicated ways in which Assad is the killer of 98% of all civilians in Syria, but there are also other killers, right? Russia, the United States, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Daesh. So I started to, it was difficult to write for a long period, and it also felt really futile in light of Syrians continuing to die and to die and to die. You know, it's what's happening in Syria is just really, really huge. It's one of just the huge, you know, it's just huge. We haven't even begun to figure out how huge it is.
And for I think, imagining, like, relentless for the people who are trying to survive it.
Yeah. And I mean, when something's not dealt with, it is having an effect on the entire world. And it is now. We're seeing that. So it's not like the world can just avoid it by, you know, turning away, because it's going to come to your shores if you're turning away from it. We're out of time.
Could I hear the poem?
Yeah.
I would love that.
So this is a poem with just words. Sentences are no longer possible. Flora, fauna, Syria. Plum trees, Syria. Cherry trees, Syria. Generic trees, Syria. Like me, like you, Syrian LGBTQ, police brutality, Razan Ghazawi, free press, student protest, city protest, water hoses, electrocuting billy clubs, live fire, laurel trees, laurel soap she handmade, Mama, what he brought me. Crates of grapes. And underneath the crates of grapes, my love packed the apple crates. Starvation sieges. Yarmouk, Khalid. Ferguson, Michael. Dariya, Riyath. Water bottles. Standing rock. Drought. Water sharing. Food sharing. Truck bed of eggplants, sarin, transparency, tanks, Tiananmen Square, Dar al-Balad, Tahrir Square, Clock Tower Square, Bayda Village, arrest sweeps, I am a free woman, daughter of a free woman, local bodies, local councils, anti-bodies, armed gangs, power sharing, solar panels, power hoarding, president for life, Adra women's prison, conscience,
unconscious. Electrocution, torture tire, Razan Zaytune, cats of Duma, olive tree, orchard, mountain, holy sea, rape farms, field clinics, field morgues, torched crops, scorched lungs, Khirota, Azadi, roommate, teacher, Metiti, cane, grain, wheat fields, able, enable, blood oven, bread oven, I am a human being. Almond trees, quince trees, walnut trees, laurel trees, laurel soap she handmade, and underneath the crate of grapes, my love packed the apple crates.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Enjoyed today's program with Moja Kaf, her book Hegar Poems. We've had three lucky book winners so far: Chaitali Jain, the Liz Wasson, and Sally Hetzel. Thanks for calling in, folks. If you'd like a book, a copy, we still have a couple more. You can call 734-763-3500 for the next about 7 minutes or so while we're still here in the studio. And if not, you can check us out on Instagram, Living Writers on Instagram, if you'd like a copy. And if we still have a copy, it shall be yours. Many thanks to Moja Kaf for coming down to the studio when she was here in Ann Arbor in March, and for the wonderful conversation. The poems, the Hegar poems, and her new poems, sharing those with us as well. Many thanks to Rima also at the Center for Middle Eastern and North African Studies. Thanks to Home George for the show's theme. Thanks to Stephanie Douglas Carpenter for engineering today. Thanks to all of you for listening. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
زخ رصاص على الناس العزل يا حيف واطفال بعمر الورد تعتقلن كيف زخ رصاص على الناس العزل يا حيف واطفال بعمر الورد تعتقلن كيف 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 وانت ابن بلادي تقتل بولادي وظهرك للعالم علي هاجم بالسيف يا حيف يا حيف ظهرك للعادي وعلي هاجم بالسيف يا حيف يا حيف وهذا اللي صاير يا الشباب يما الحرية عالباب يما طلعوا يهتفوا لا شافوا البواريد يما قالوا اخوتنا هن ومش رح يضربونا سمعت هالشباب يما الحرية عالباب يما طلعوا يهتفوا لا شافوا البواريد يمه قالوا اخوتنا هن ومش رح يضربونا ضربونا
متنه يمه بالرصاص الحي متنه بيد اخوتنا باسم امن الوطن واحنا مين احنا واسألوا التاريخ يقرا صفحتنا متنه بيد اخوتنا باسم امن الوطن باسم امن الوطن واحنا مين احنا واسألوا التاريخ يقرا صفحتنا صفحتنا مش داري السجان يمه كلمة حرية وحدي هزت له أركانه ومن هتفة لجموع يمه أصبح كالملسوع يمه يصلينا بنيرانه مش داري السجان يمه كلمة حرية وحدي هزت له أركانه من هتفة لجموع يمه أصبح كالملسوع يمه يصلينا بنيرانه واحنا اللي قلنا اللي بيقتل شعبه خاين يكون من كاين شعبي مثل القدر من ينتخي ماين شعبي مثل القدر والأمل باين باين يكون من كاين شعبي مثل القدر من ينتخي ماين شعبي مثل القدر والأمل باين باين يا حيف أخو يا حيف زخر صاص على الناس العزل يا حيف واطفال بعمر الورد اعتقلن كيف زخر صاص على الناس العزل يا حيف واطفال بعمر الورد اعتقلن كيف 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 وانت ابن بلادي تقتل بولادي وظهرك للعادي وعلي هاجم بالسيف يا حافن يا حافن ظهرك للعادي وعلي هاجم بالسيف يا حافن يا حافن وهيدا اللي صاير يا
الحب استنيها أما قلبي تنسيه أمرة الحب استنيها أما قلبي تنسيه عيشة لا حب فيها جدول لا ماء فيه جدول لا ماء فيه جدول لا ما في أمرة الحب سقينيها أم قلبي تنسيني عيشة لا حب فيها جدول لا ما فيه جدول لما فيه جدول لا ماء فيه. الحب استنينا أما قلبي تنسيني أمرة الحب استنينا أما قلبي تنسيني ريشة لا حب فيها جدول